Hello, and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, David Brothers, Christopher Butcher, and myself, Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com. Today we're talking about volumes 3-5 of the Seven Seas series, BL Metamorphosis, by Kaori Tsurotani. Avid listeners will remember that we covered volumes 1-2 last season. But with the recent, or upcoming, I don't know when this airs, release of Volume 5, the final volume, I thought it'd be a nice idea to close out the series here in Season 2. For those unfamiliar, BL Metamorphosis revolves around a unique friendship between an elderly woman named Ichinoi? I want to say Ichinoi? Great. And a teenage girl named Arara. What brings them together is a mutual zeal for boys love manga, a type of manga where a boy loves another boy very much. Now, because we're talking about the end of a series, I highly recommend you pause this episode and come back when you've finished it, because as always, we're going to be pretty spoiler heavy. So yeah, we're back with some more BL love. As host, I don't have to go first, which is fantastic. So I am going to toss it out to, let's see, I get to do this, so I'm going to say Christopher. Christopher. We did volumes.
Always picking on me.
We did volumes 1-2 last season, and we all really enjoyed it. What are your thoughts on volumes 3-5?
Well, for those of you who haven't listened to the previous episode on BL Metamorphosis and from season 1, I actually loved 1 and 2 so much that I just kept reading and read 3 and 4 as well, and then kicked myself because I had to not spoil it for everybody else who hadn't read them on the first podcast. So I think it's pretty safe to say I was really looking forward to Volume 5, which we should point out was provided by Seven Seas as a review copy so that we could actually review it, even though we record early and blah, blah, blah. It was really kind of them to send us Volume 5. We paid for 1-4, so don't get any ideas.
We're still clean.
I was so worried reading this the last volume today. I was so worried because Ichinoi is very old.
Yes.
And I almost cried at one point. I got really teary, actually, reading this book. And then it ended in a really beautiful way. And I believe it stuck the landing from this like 5 volumes of buildup in a way that I don't think I saw coming. And I really appreciated. And that's what I have to say about it is I'm really happy about it. I'm going to let someone else spoil it for a change.
So Chris is really happy that the old lady died. Yeah. Is that what you're
weird,
saying?
Right?
You kind of already spoiled it. She's
2021 dead. Dark as shit. Like, yeah. She didn't die. I'm glad she didn't die. But also change, I guess. You know, death is just big change, right? And the change at the end of the series is pretty monumental. And I didn't see any of that coming. Where she up and just moves out of Japan. Like, whoa. <It's, laughs> like, yeah. In her like late 70s, she just ups and leaves Japan forever. And that is a lot. Like, it was so much, but it made perfect sense. And it was, I just reread 3 and 4 again after I read Volume 5. And it's sort of telegraphed a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like it comes up early on, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, where like she can't live with her daughter because her daughter and her are both stubborn and they're so different and yada, yada, yada. The big theme of this one was memory. Of Volume 5, the last volume, is memory. She's losing her memory. And she doesn't have Alzheimer's or anything like that, knock on wood. But she is recognizing that she's getting older. She's getting more forgetful. She's losing things. And she realized that maybe she is going to need somebody else and need to be with somebody else. And her daughter offers. And it's like heartbreaking because it means that the end of her friendship with Urata, who we've grown to love this relationship between these two ladies. So it made me tear up a little bit, but it was good. It was really good.
The interesting thing you said there was about how it was like, it was a monumental change at the end.
The one interesting thing surrounded by my fucking endless nattering.
Yeah. You went on, but what I found fascinating was nothing in the series, including the ending, was monumental. Like everything was treated quietly and kind of matter-of-factly. Even the last couple of pages, you know, there's a lot of space given to the main character in the empty space of the old lady's home. But it's very kind of matter-of-fact. Like her on the phone saying, I found the books. Yeah, all right, I'll send them today. Like, that's it. Like, because it's the reader's more invested in the relationship than the characters are.
Yeah.
Right?
I think also the most monumental thing doesn't happen because Urara is too nervous to talk to the cartoonist when they finally meet.
Yeah.
Because if the cartoonist had said, like, oh, your book was really cool, like, that would have been... That would have been like the coming of age movie moment when like, yeah. the music comes up and she's like, oh, this is my path. But yep. instead, it's just kind of a, like, there's a song lyric I like a lot from Childish Gambino's song Baby Boy, where he says, there was a time before you and there will be a time after you. And it yeah. sort of puts into place like the context of what's happening. Like, you're here, this is your time, and everything has its own time. Like, nothing lasts forever. So I think their friendship changes, but it's not over necessarily. You know, she's still yeah. mailing books to her friend. Like, they can't hang out the way they once did, but they introduce like video calling.
But they also weren't constantly hanging out. Like, that's the other thing. Like, it's there's not a huge difference. Like, anyways, I'm derailing a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's the manga explaining way.
Yeah, David, since you chimed in there, you're next. How did you feel about volumes 3 to 5?
I was so relieved the old lady didn't die. Like, that was yeah. my main worry, you know, which is very, like, facile, but it would have kind of decided the tone of what the book was.
Yeah.
And I think because, you know, I'm sure it's still clear, you know, she's very old and this is kind of the twilight era for her, but she has this new interest. Like, she's been opened up a little bit by making a new friend, and it's kind of implied that leads to a better relationship with her daughter.
Yeah.
Her daughter understands her better now. She's more open to the things her daughter's into. Like, she's looking back at her life, you know, like Chris said, looking back at her memories and kind of realizing all these good times that she once had.
Yeah.
And the end result is a book that I think of, it's almost like the best picture of all the pros of being a fan of comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the relationships, like the sharing the thing. When they meet for tea to discuss the final chapter, like, yeah. I've done that so many times.
That's,
you know,
so sweet, yeah.
Whether it's like, you know, okay, we all saw Tenet, like, what happened? Or, you know, this is the new 52, like, what books did you read? Let's all get on, like, a big call and talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a fun, real thing to me. There were so many things in this book that were very real to me for literal and figurative reasons. Like, I've done the walk that she does to Tokyo Big Sight.
Yeah.
Thanks to Chris. That was my second trip to Tokyo. When we exhibited at Comitia, which they talk about in the book, which I'm sure we'll get into later on. I don't want to monopolize it. But yeah, very into it. I think that they nailed it. It was like the right kind of sentimental. And the fact that it was so mundane, like you were saying, like, there's nothing monumental going on, just a series of like minor emotional catharsis at best.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of living with these people otherwise. It made it really entertaining and really resonant for me, really strong work.
Yeah. Yeah. Deb, how about you?
Oh, yeah. I think all the things everyone was saying, it rings true for me. It was really sweet. I mean, the way the mood of this book, the emotional mood of this book stays at a pretty steady beat. You know, like, there's no, and then this happened, and oh, and then that happened. You know, like, the revelations that come are just kind of like, oh, that's kind of nice. Like, when we find out that the man that Ichinoi has been talking to, the older man that she's been talking to, and he repays her loan, we find out that he's a printer. He runs a print shop. And that's just a lovely little revelation. Like, oh, that's why that character kept coming in. And the way that he offers to print her book, he's like, oh, well, yeah. Well, you don't have to, but offset printing sure looks nice. Like, everyone is super cool about it, you know?
I laughed out loud at that moment, by the way. Like, did you? Publishing, like, just, there was just something about it where I could hear the voice of the guy saying it.
Yeah.
But yes, go for it.
No, so many cute moments, right? That were, and the part where the Kometa-san, the manga artist, and Urada-san just keep missing each other is in the last volume is almost like, that's about as much drama as you got. And it was slightly frustrating. But it led up to what I thought was the emotional climax of the book was when she tells her, the artist at the signing, your book brought us, me and my friend together. And I thought, so sweet. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I was like beating the drum and saying like, I hope she doesn't die. I hope she doesn't die. And it just ended up being like, oh yeah. It's the same as how the rest of the book was very matter of fact and very emotionally, you know, mellow, I guess. There was no moment at the end where you were just like going, shit, what? But there's so many good moments in this book that, you know, like, I don't know whether it's because, like, I exhibited a comedian was selling at one point, like when I went on a tour. I could relate to so many of those feelings, right? Like there's a feeling when you're in front of, when you're buying, and there's a feeling when all of a sudden you're on the other side of the tables telling people, I have a book. You want to buy it?
Yeah.
And you have all these hopes and dreams about it. And then it ends up being like, you know, like at the end of the day, it's like, wow, actually people walking this show have a choice of hundreds of thousands of other books to buy. And I was pretty lucky to maybe sell 20.
Yeah.
You know? So that's that kind of heart, that kind of sense of, you know, hope and heartbreak, I could relate to a lot. I thought she was really spot on with the experience.
Yeah, she really nailed the feeling of selling $2 worth of books.
But how important it was to her as well that she made those $2, or she keeps those 200 yen coins with her forever. I think that's awesome.
But also when she points out, like, make the price more visible, like people might like to know that it's cheap, you know?
Yeah.
That's also such like a real con life thing.
Oh God. Yeah.
It totally is. Totally is.
Such crazy con flashbacks throughout the entire thing. Like, David, have you ever, you used to sell books obviously for Image. You used to work at cons pretty hard. Have you ever done it for your own stuff?
Once at TCAF, and I've done it several times for friends, and they're all like very different experiences. You know, like selling for Image, it's very much like, it's like the most commercial, even though like you're selling sometimes very personal books, like it's a volume game, I guess.
Yeah.
But selling for friends, you have like a little more, the enthusiasm's different. You're almost selling your friendship in addition to the story. And selling your own work, it's like a whole other level of scary. Scary's probably too strong of a word, but like there's
scary's a good word.
You know, there's like very much nerves involved in there, and putting your own work on display when it's just yourself, and then having conversations about it to convince people that, you know, that it's worth your time or their time. Like selling someone else's book is easy because you find the one thing that's like marketable and you capitalize on it, like figuratively and literally. But when it's your thing, you know everything. So you're like, oh, but like this is the good part, but it's set up by this part. So you got to choose, like, start here. And by then, like, they've walked away, you know?
Yeah.
It feels a little bit like going on a date, right? Where you're like, you want to seem too desperate, but at the same time, you want to be approachable so that people will actually pick it up.
Yeah. You're actually really desperate.
You don't want to be pushy. And it's like, oh, it's such an awkward feeling.
I highly recommend doing it by creating an entirely different persona.
Yeah. What do you mean, Chip?
I did not think of that.
I mean, it's very different for me, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, the different persona helped. But the early shows I was doing, like, you know, Wizard World in 2000, 2001, I was selling a dark humor comedy book called Prison Funnies. And because it was, you know, a comedy book, I would always just be like, with cowboy hat on, trying to sell, and be like, hey, take a look at it. Flip through, read a couple of these. If you laugh, great, buy it. If you don't, move on. That's fine. So that made it really easy for me because I never took it personally. Like somebody looked at it and was like, I'm just going to put it down, muttered and walked off and be like, they're a square.
Yeah.
Like they're not cool. They don't get it. They don't get me. And frankly, I don't want their business. Like that made it easy for me because I was never selling my art. Right? Like I wasn't selling like a book. Oh, here's my personal journey. And then they would look at it and like, I don't want your personal journey. Like I think that would feel a lot different. So for me, it was it was always fine if I made like $10 or I made a couple $100 at a show, as long as the book got into the hands of the people that it needed to get into the hands of, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I still related to the feeling of like sitting behind a table and not quite knowing what to do. And yeah, maybe make the price more prominent. Not only from my own experiences, but watching everyone around me, because that's almost as heartbreaking as yourself not doing well, is seeing somebody like mopey across from you.
Yeah.
You know, with zero sales for a weekend.
Yeah, that's really motivating, I think. Selling is performance, I think, behind a table.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I forget what recent series we're talking about where I said I love the fact the main character turned out to not be some great artist. Which book?
Oh, it was Blank. No, it was... I was going to say Blank Canvas, but that's not what
it was.
Yeah,
but that's not it. But one of them, I was like, oh, I was kind of overjoyed the fact that like their creative output actually wasn't like that great.
Yeah.
Because that's such a trope in stories. And so here, the fact that like, again, she made 200 yen and didn't know how to sell and wanted to wrap up early, like, and the drawings weren't very good. Like, mm-hmm. I love that fact. That it wasn't about that. It wasn't about like, you know, ascending to stardom like the character did it, wanted to in Blank Canvas with their fantasies of everyone wearing her character's hairdo.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, this is very much just about the act of doing a thing is the reward and having the experience.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you wouldn't know what it was like.
I really do think that if you've ever made your own comics and sold your own comics, especially anywhere in the world, Volume 4 and 5, the whole like going to Comitia for the first time, selling your stuff, and then like the response to it and things like that is going to really, really hit, whether you've unfortunately never been to big Tokyo Big Sight or not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just want to stress like how good and how real that was and how it felt. It felt good. Like it wasn't even necessarily all good feelings, because you're like, oh man, that was me. I was the mopey guy one time. But like it felt good because it felt honest. Mm-hmm. And this book has so much honesty going for it, even when it's painful. And I think that that's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a cute moment where like she drops off the manga at the printer and she's like hopping away and she goes, is drawing manga fun? And it's like, oh, like, that was fun, you know, like doing it. And then when she gets the printed books, she goes, this feels so disconnected from my act of drawing this to seeing this in my hands.
Yeah.
So this whole, all these rushes of emotions and feelings that she's having, you never, like in some manga, like Blue Giant, for example, like it starts off with your knowledge that this guy is going to be a genius jazz saxophonist. Like, and this happens a lot in shonen manga. It's like, oh, this guy, he's so gifted, you know? And if only like he can get to this point where he will reach his level of greatness. We just know, like even in like any sports manga, right? Like Haikyuu, it's like, oh, Haikyuu, he's not so sharp, but he's going to be great someday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With BL Metamorphosis, there is no promise that Urara will someday become a great BL manga artist or that she's inherently very talented. But it's the journey that's done so thoughtfully.
Mm-hmm.
I find that nice and refreshing.
I was going to bring up that same moment where she remembers making the comic and then she like holds the comic. Cause that was another thing where I was like, this feels so resonant to me. Like I used to work in video games doing like consulting, technical writing and doing strategy guides. So I've been published a bunch, but not like for my stuff. It's always like, here's how you beat, you know, SOCOM confrontation. So like having books like stopped being special to me with my name on it, you know?
Yeah.
But being at a con changes that, because it reminds you like, oh, it's the community of the thing. It's talking to people about the book. Like at TCAF, I was selling a book of prose. And one of the best conversations I had all weekend was with this older dude who wasn't even there for comics. He was just there for the library.
Yeah.
And he saw like a certain gun on the cover of the book and was like, oh, one of these. And I said something glib, but like factually accurate in response. And it led to a whole conversation about the history of the gun. And then he bought the book and left. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, I get it now.
Yeah.
Because it's never the actual, the selling part. It's like the connection at shows. Otherwise, you could just, you know, sell online or mail order.
Yeah. A side note, that was my favorite thing about exhibiting at TCAF, which was the people who came in who had no idea what comics were.
Yeah.
That was always, that was always amazing. And like, I love having conversations with those people.
Yeah.
For them, it's just like, well, I had no idea. Like, I bought Archie when I was a kid, and look at this.
It's really nice to hear that, because honestly, the people who had no idea about comics, the only ones I ever dealt with were the ones who were angry.
That, oh, yeah, of course.
I have no idea what's going on with comics, but this is not my library like it's supposed to be, and yeah. I am angry.
Yeah.
You have to have those conversations. So it's nice to hear it on the other side that people had a good time.
That happened a fair amount, and I think, I'm sorry that it ended up that you only heard the bad stuff, but I think that happens with almost all media.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all endeavors, you will only hear the complaints and the people who are generally happy and pleased. You just have to, I guess the only way you're going to get it is psychically, because they won't tell it to you.
Like, we'll just hold that in our hearts.
Just hold it in your heart, then you feel sure that somebody out there is grateful and happy. It sucks, but yeah.
One of the things I really loved about the whole storyline about her making her own comic and exhibiting it and dealing with all that, and also, you know, meeting the author, it really reinforced to me how low of a barrier there is to get into comics.
Yeah.
Like, because thinking back on when I first did them, I was just like, oh, I've got enough strips to make a comic. Oh, I guess I'll just send them to this printer and they'll give me copies. And then I just pay a bit for a table, and then I go to a table and I sell the comics. And you're suddenly you're a comic writer or a comic artist, cartoonist.
Compared to trying to be an aspiring filmmaker, which is expensive, requires more people. And
Exactly. I mean, there's, you know, you can do it with prose, but even still, there isn't that kind of, I mean, obviously prose, different genres have different communities, but comics just feels like such a different thing. I think just because it's a visual medium.
It's easier to read. Like, selling short stories in prose versus selling short stories in comics is like two different worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you can tell from across the aisle whether or not you want to read that book, whereas you can't with short stories or novels.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really kind of heartwarming just seeing this, like, this teenage girl make her own book, get the table, sell a couple of copies, just to have that experience. Like, yeah, I just found that really heartwarming.
And I love that it was her very first book. Like, when she was like, oh, I'll make a book and, like, we'll exhibit together, I was like, oh, that's really sweet. And then I was like, wait, but does she draw? You know?
Yeah.
It takes Ichinoi a little bit to figure out, like, oh, that's what you meant by selling at this show. You're going to draw something.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't occur to her.
Yeah.
And I think if she had been, you know, like Deb was saying, if she had been, like, destined to be a great artist or even a good artist, it would have been a very different type of book. It would have been about her journey towards succeeding at Comitia versus their journey towards sharing their love of BL together and kind of like accepting this next step in their life alongside each other before they step apart from each other.
Yeah, this wasn't a shonen manga where there's like this big goal and you got to go defeat that goal, and then there's a bigger goal and you got to defeat that.
Lots of little goals.
Yeah, lots of they're very, very tiny, and it's funny. Like, I'd say about halfway through volume 4, I realized that the old lady wasn't going to die.
Really?
Did you?
Because this isn't that kind of story. But I did have the thought, like, okay, she's not going to die at the end of the story, but I could very much see an epilogue that's like 10 years later, where you find out, you know, what happened to the characters, kind of thing.
I'm so glad they didn't do that, though.
When I saw the flash forward, like 5 months after, I was like, oh, this is it.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was going to happen. And then I was like, oh, they got me after all.
Yeah. I do wonder if the author thought that.
Like, I think
as soon as she was like, I'm going to add a little 5 months later, and then everyone's hearts are going to, like, skip a beat.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
But that reminded me, there's a little, in the author's note, they revealed or volume 5 author's note, they reveal that a lot of what the older lady says is from the author's grandmother, as filtered by the author's younger sister. And I love that too. Like, I think it's such like a cute it explains why the grandmother feels the way she does, which is very warm, very open, but also like kind of cool at the same time, like someone to look up to.
Yeah.
There was that thing at the end of volume three too, where it's the author's note says, "Thank you for sharing all your lovely stories about your grandparents. I'm sad it's only me and my editor reading them."
I would have been crying thinking about reading that.
Yeah.
That's so sweet. Yeah.
Only me and my editor stealing them, more likely.
Yeah.
I think Urano has like a lot of, it comes to a lot of very emotional realizations in the last three volumes. Like the moment where she's, I think it's in volume three, where she said, "It scared me to see how a whole person's life could be sorted into a bunch of silent piles."
Mm.
Like, you know, the dishes and stuff like that. And then her mother and her father are, you know, arguing about Urano, and then the mother saying, "I just want to guide her gently. I don't want to force her to any molds." Like these little moments that reveal little things about what Urano's life is like, what she's going through, just as much as you're seeing little glimpses of Ichinoi's life, right? Where she goes to the nursing home and they say matter of fact, "Oh yeah, and here's the graveyard where anyone who dies gets buried."
It's, oh, convenient.
You know, yeah.
Like, and then she goes and sees her friends, Ichinoi sees her friends her age, and then she goes, "Oh, you know, like, and you discover it's not that she doesn't have friends. It's just they don't see each other very often."
Yeah.
And there's the moment where she's excited to find out one of her friends is still alive, too, that really kind of touched
from
me.
From the New Year's card? Oh, I know. My mom does that. Like, they read the newspaper just to check out the obituaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To see who's still, you know, like, "Oh, yeah, he died. Oh, yeah, he died." So matter of fact.
If it's a small enough community, you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Had those pages open, actually, because it was one of the things I wanted to talk about. It scared me to see how a whole person's life could just be sorted into a bunch of silent piles like that when she's talking about the dishes. And it's just like, yeah, I think that that's when we talk about little realizations that Urano makes. I think Chippy had a really good point there. And it's just like, this person is 15, you know what I mean? And terrified of the world and terrified of everything and thinks that everything's the most important thing. And at the beginning of the volume, there's such a good note. "I've been thinking maybe it's okay to just try stuff whenever. That never occurred to me until recently. I figured I had to be old enough before I could do different things. But maybe anytime's okay, like even now." And it's just, and then you get to the end and you realize that, like, and then she realizes again, like, oh, you can try things. And oh, people do compartmentalize. Like, people do put things in their place. And yeah, it too. Good realizations that bookend volume three. And it's one of the things that really affected me about the series more than anything that I was probably talking about on the last episode. Just this idea that, like, who you think you are isn't fixed. And it's certainly not fixed at 15. And then in the last volume, we see that it's not necessarily fixed at, you know, in your 70s either. You can go up and do something that's completely out of character, but is just like you change your life in this way because it's what you need at that moment. And I think that the book is so good at, like, driving that point home.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that part of it, for sure.
Is there a word for a coming-of-age story for, like, a 70-year-old person? Like, I don't, if that's, I'm sure it's already a genre, but it feels like a coming-of-age story from both angles, where Urano is graduating high school and moving into whatever her college career is going to be. I think they're very vague about it in the book, to my memory. And Ichinoi is moving to the U.S., you know, possibly for the final phase of her life, but also...
I think it's Germany.
Yeah.
Oh, Germany. German?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was all the way back in volume one or two that it was Germany, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Even further from Japan. Or maybe not. I don't know how globes work.
10 hours, she says.
But it's a whole new phase of her life, and it's a phase that she had to kind of prepare herself for, like learning how to do passports. But now, thanks to her friendship with Urano, she knows how to use smartphones and video chat and even kind of a way to keep in contact despite the distance that isn't just like trading New Year's cards every, you know, year or every now and again.
Yeah.
All the scenes with her and her friends were really cute, too. Where they're like trading pictures and talking about their, you know, late husbands and like dressing up and stuff.
It's actually really nice. It's really
yeah.
Super sweet.
So gentle.
That's the one thing. It's such a super gentle series. in the way it tells the story and the story itself and in the characters. Because like the one thing I've noticed a lot in the manga we've read, especially when teenagers are involved, is the outsized emotions. Mm-hmm. And here it's the exact opposite. Mm. Like no matter what the realization is, Arara stays very much the same. Like it's an internal thing. It's not flailing arms and like, oh, I can't believe, you know, the deadline is in like 3 weeks.
It's all internal.
She's flailing internally though. Like it's still the same outsized emotion, but she's inward. She's self-destructive.
Yeah.
In that way. Like she's exhausted all the time because anytime she thinks about anything, it's exhausting. You know what I mean? Like it's too much. And she's just like constantly like lying across a set of kitchen chairs or lying on the floor.
That was such
like
a good drawing.
Yeah.
That segue through her parents talking to her and like, oh, yeah, she'll be okay.
Yeah.
I loved that.
She's exhausted all the time, but also it's just the mode of the whole story. Mm-hmm. Like no character has the outsized physical reactions, which obviously really suits the tone of the book itself. I did find like when I was reading volumes 3 and 4, I did find it maybe a little meandering, a little slow, and kind of the same way where maybe I'll get like kind of like not upset, but just kind of like a little exhausted with like beautiful poetry, you know, like I recognize what it's doing, but I kind of want the story to kind of progress a bit more than what it has been. Though in retrospect, I'm like, oh no, actually, I get it a bit more now that I finished it all. And thinking back on it, I'm like, oh, okay, it had to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I had the realization probably in the middle of volume 4 that maybe I'm not smart enough for this book.
Oh, come on.
Why is that?
Well, just because I am like, come on, where's the plot? Where's the plot? Who's that character? I don't want what. Why is that?
But you
why
got it in the end, I think.
I know. Why is it a panel of a bird? Why is this a panel of a tree? What does this scene mean? Like, yeah, it took me a while to kind of catch up to what was happening in terms of the pacing.
How many days did you read 3, 4, and 5 over? Did you like spend the full week with it, or did you just cram it, or what?
I did a volume a day.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I think if you had had, I think you. Here's something for
but
the
also readers. Okay, here's the thing. So before you say anything, I'm recognizing a thing in myself for the podcast where because I'm reading and I know there's a deadline on it, even if I do give myself days, I might be going through it just a bit too fast. My mind's blanking at the series that I really love that I kept reading.
Tokyo Tadadeba Girls?
Yes. Yeah, so I immediately went to the next volume, and I enjoyed it even more than the previous volumes. And then because I took time with it.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't kind of a bit of the pressure of like, oh, I've got to finish this by a certain date, which is almost all my reading for work. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a series that I'll probably down the road reread, probably in physical format, just to be slower with it and kind of take it in more.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that this is a series that either you have to read all at once because it's slow and light, you can read it quickly and sort of take it all in, or like volume 4 and volume 5 had, I think, 8 months in between their releases because they would caught up to the Japanese editions. So this is a book that you could have, I guess, if you were reading it on your own, really luxuriated in and maybe reread a couple of times and then maybe reread, you know, 3 and 4 because the story sort of ends at 2 and then restarts in 3, 4, and 5 as like one long sort of thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
No, man, I totally feel that. I think in the middle. Yeah, let's leave it at I totally feel what you're saying on the one hand. And on the other, that's just the artificial nature of talking about a book on a podcast, I think. I think if we were just reading books to get together, the conversation would probably be, I think the conversation would be pretty similar, but the way we interact with the books might be different.
There'd be a lot more cussing. A
lot more cussing.
But there's a long moment where she goes to Tokyo Big Sight. And it kind of details the process to get there, the walk, kind of the stops you go to. And I think that's one of those kind of slow moments, but that actually almost unsettled me a little bit because it's what we did when we exhibited at Comitia for TCAF in Tokyo. When I had barely any Japanese, I had like hi, dozo, and like yakiniku wo kudasai, and like that was it, you know?
Yeah.
So it was both disorienting, but also really vivid, kind of riding this train out to, for all I knew, the middle of nowhere to possibly be murdered in a foreign country.
It's funny because when we went and did the superhero con with Chip, it's actually out in Chiba. So it's like the trip that you had, except it, the train ride was like an extra 35 minutes long to somewhere that was even more the middle of nowhere.
Was it Tokyo Comic Con?
Yeah, the Tokyo Comic Con.
I was there for Stan Lee's opening speech or whatever at that show.
Oh, really?
And that one was just like...
It was weird.
Yeah.
Please elaborate.
It was just one of those weird, sad, like, and here's Stan Lee. And like he comes out and does like the Stan Lee patter, and then they kind of, you know, usher him off stage. But clearly one of those things where he had no reason to be there beyond like money and just that's it.
Yeah.
Not that money's bad, but it was like there's a difference between like Stan Lee on Marvel stuff, you know, and then Stan Lee playing Stan Lee.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Can't wait to get that phase of my career.
Yeah.
It's not that you're not doing cons anymore. It's that you're doing cons when you're getting Stan Lee money to show up.
But all the Comitia stuff, you know, selling to the crowd and like stealing a moment to run around the show. I think, Deb, you took me around the show at Comitia that first time and kind of showed me the ropes because I knew it was only original work, but I didn't know there was like, you know, homemade watches and things like that there. You know, just ridiculous levels of craft that's all... made by hand, like all made by a person, made by a fan or made by a human being.
It's incredibly different type of show. It's not what you expect.
Yeah, it's true. And it doesn't feel like a craft fair. It feels like a convention, you know. They did a great job capturing that vibe, I think.
I think the first time I went to Comitia was through Pop Japan Travel. I went with Ben Applegate. He was a tour guide at the time.
Oh, wow.
And Applegate now works for Penguin Random House. The deal was, the part of the tour was, I went with Becky Cloonan and Liesl Gallagher and a bunch of us all went on this manga tour. And the premise was that we would create a book and we would get it printed in Japan and it would be, we could sell it there. So it was this whole experience, right, of getting your doujinshi and like sending it to the printer and then arriving at the show at the table and there's a box there with your name on it. And this is the first time you're seeing the book, you know? So that was the first time that was a pretty special tour because it was so geared towards people who were interested in making manga.
Yeah.
We got to meet manga artists. We did all kinds of things that were pretty special, but you know, going to Comitia that first time was, wow, this is so different. It was not like any American show that I'd ever been to.
Yeah.
And then I think we had to figure out what, like the magazine is basically like a catalog. It's both your ticket to get in and a catalog of the show. And it's like these little boxes that have the name of the artist and a little drawing. And then there's a big map that says, this area has travel manga. This area has boys love manga. This area has girls love manga. And it's like, it's all mapped out. And you could go down a whole row of just cat manga. Yes.
Heaven.
A whole row of just essay manga about all kinds of random shit, like best curry and cute pinup girls with different types of vintage cameras. Like, it is just...
Was that one real?
Yes, I have one. Okay. If you want it, I'll give it to you.
So that sounds very familiar.
And then the one I keep talking about, right?
Soda can one?
Cans in love.
Yeah.
Love. We're keeping this PG, right? You got to raise my swear from the beginning of the episode. But yeah, I actually, at that Comitia, I bought a Tom York from Radiohead themed doujinshi about, I think he was in love or he was in love with the author. It's a whole thing. Anyway.
I bought the Rammstein doujinshi.
Oh, the Rammstein one. Yeah, yeah.
Man.
Oh,
wasn't the Tom York one called Radiohead Head?
It's so special.
that kind of experience is so, like, tons of people go to comic conventions, I think, but us in particular have had the relatively unique experience of having had most of the experiences in this book.
Yeah. You
know, going to shows, making a book, being a fan.
Befriending an old lady.
Yeah, befriending an old lady and getting her to, like, let you use her apartment to hang out in with all of your hoodlum friends.
Yep.
So there's so much where I'm just like, wow, like, this is really, it feels so warm to me.
Yeah.
Like, everything we've been talking about, you know, is part of it. But then also the book's not afraid to just say what its themes are. Mm-hmm. Like, when the author comes to Kamitia and she's like, oh, this is like a foundational doujinshi event. My heart almost bursts. And she's just saying her feelings. And normally that's bad writing.
Yeah.
But it works because I'm like, you know, she's saying what I'm feeling too.
yeah, exactly. It's funny. I wonder how other people who aren't in comics or have exhibited comics would feel about mm-hmm. those scenes. Mm. Like, would it just be a bit more like explainer manga at that point?
There's no translation notes at the end to explain a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you can just accept a lot of it too. Mm. Like, you're at a show, the box is at your table, like, then there's some kind of organization back there. You might not know that this is part of, like, the incredibly efficient setup process that they have.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily need to.
You also don't get a sense of the scale of Kamitia.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
In that scene, it looks like, oh, it's kind of like going to, I don't know, SPX, or it's like going to APE. In reality, it is like going to 3 comic cons with just artist alley tables.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's ludicrous. The
scale is not conveyed in this.
The last fun Japanese manga thing in here that I saw was she just knows someone who owns a printer.
Yeah.
And I feel like that would never happen in North America. You might know someone who owns like a Riso or like a press or something like that.
Yeah.
But an entire print shop and can just do a book for you? No way. That's like a fairy tale.
I don't know. If I could say one thing about this episode, it is the opposite of a fairy tale in Japan. It is so easy to become a self-published artist in Japan, a doujinshi artist. Like, I did it. I did it, and I didn't have any Japanese at the time. I just sent them a bunch of files, and there was a box of books waiting at my table. Like, it was awesome that this is a thing that you can do. As long as you've got, like, $400, like, you can throw together a pretty solid doujinshi. And you don't have to you don't have to interact with printers. You don't have to, like, worry about shit. It's, you literally download a template, drop your art into it, and then re-upload the template file, and they just print it the way you want it. And it's just the best. Like, because it's so set up for people to do that. Like, and there was a time in North American comics where it looked like comics might might actually get to that point. There's some old school shit, so I apologize if you don't care because it's not about manga, but there was a print broker. His name was Harold Buchholz back in the, like, late 90s, early 2000s. And he would be the guy that interfaced with a printer for you. So if you're an indie guy, you literally send him, like, high-res JPEGs of your artwork, TIFFs if you wanted to. He would turn it into a book, deal with the printer, and then send you digital print-to-order files back. That was awesome. I know Prenny used to do that, where they would, like, you could send them 32 black and white pages, and they would photograph them, photograph them and then print them for you and send it back. There used to be all these different ways, and the comics industry's gotten so small and so weird, frankly, that there's just aren't a lot of printers. There aren't a lot of people doing digital print to order in that way anymore. Even Amazon has stopped Comixology Submit for doing, like, print on demand stuff and having your stuff up on Comixology just in the last couple of weeks. And this is still a thriving going concern in Japan. And it just, there's work to support it.
This is the pandemic has made things hard for some people.
Oh yeah. I should say, as of November 2019, it's a thriving going thing in Japan. I think when all the dust settles, it's going to be a different industry, but you can still get I'll put one link in the show notes, cause there's like a million of them where you can just go and get your work printed if you really want to. In Japan, you won't be there to get it. Unfortunately, you can't get into the country, but, you know, you could have a doujinshi sitting in the Kamitia Hall if you really want to.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of cool. And I think a lot of people are going digital now. I think a lot of people are making comics, going Kickstarter, but, like, yeah, the thrill of being able to, like, draw a comic and put it together and have it debut at a show, if you've only got 20 pages and you don't need to run a giant campaign for it and you don't need to, like, leverage your social media, you could just show up. I think that that's really valuable. on its own merits. And it's something that we are really losing. And it's unfortunate. I don't think we're thinking about what we're losing.
I should mention it now because I'll never remember to email it to you. But my friend Caleb Goldner, who I'm actually going to put out like a short comic with later this year, he exhibited at Comic-Con and wrote up a whole long blog post about it, kind of how he did, who he talked to. And it works as instructions. So yeah, when our borders are open again, go for broke.
I've read that. It's really good, actually.
Yeah.
Great thing. I recommend it as well. So yeah, that'll be in the show notes. Thanks. We never asked Chip what he thought. He just sort of jumped in on everybody else's. And usually we turn it around on the host at some point and be like, what did you actually think, Chip? But I feel like, I don't know. Do you feel like you've given that? We could just let David go back into what he wanted to say.
I think I've made my feelings known on the subject.
All right.
I very much enjoyed it. Like I said, I thought volumes 3 and 4 were maybe too much of a slow burn. On retrospect, maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe you're right. They canceled it at 5, or it ended, air quotes, at 5. You never know, right?
It felt like the proper ending, though.
It felt like the right ending.
Yeah.
I think even in 3 and 4, it's like, you can see that this is a very finite story.
Hmm.
Because, like, what do you do after exhibiting meeting the author?
Mm-hmm.
I would read a sequel to this, though, wouldn't you? Like, sorry, there's a couple hints that maybe Urara is just as interested in girls as boys that come up. There's a thread in volume 3 and then again in volume 5 where she talks about how that one classmate is really pretty and how she isn't sure how she feels about that. Mm-hmm. There's the boyfriend that she never really gets to. There's like so many little threads that...
There are a lot of threads, but I mean...
I'm okay with leaving them dangling, honestly.
Yeah. Like that's kind of the beauty of the story, is the fact that it's all about leaving it dangling, right?
I want to live in this universe and just want to bathe in their warm, loving friendship forever, frankly. So
I guess you want to find out what happened with Rorschach's diary at the end of Watchmen, eh? fans.
What's Watchmen? I don't understand what is that nerd shit? I don't really nerd shit.
They're the kind of dangling threads that I think, like, they're not obvious, but they're meant for you to be the ones to tug on them a little bit.
Yeah.
Because one thing that really struck me is they're in the Boys Love manga that Urara and Ishinori have been reading, there's a moment where like they admit their feelings for each other. And it's followed by what I'm pretty sure was like a platonic friend confirmation between Urara and her like male friend, like her childhood friend, because there's no romance between them at all, but there's a very deep friendship.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like he has that moment where he asks her to come to see his ex off at the airport or like part of the way. And it's just comforting.
And she gives him advice to do it. She encourages him to do it, you know, because otherwise he'll regret it. And that's not a romantic type of like encouragement. That's like, you're my buddy.
Yeah.
This is the right thing for you to do.
Yeah.
And juxtaposing that with the two guys, like they just moved in together, like they're sharing coffee or tea or whatever it is people drink when they move. When I'm with you, I understand the shape of me. It's sort of about finding your place, and everyone's place is sort of in relation to someone else, because Urara goes on to say, like, I want to make you feel that way too. I think thinking about, you know, Ichinoi, like she wants to be that kind of friend for Ichinoi as well as her childhood friend.
Mm. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
But I also thought what was interesting was that what doesn't really get explored sometimes is what is the appeal of boys love manga, right? To women.
Mm.
You know, like why are people so obsessed with it? Why do women like reading stories about men loving men? Like what's the deal? The point that I got was on volume 4, page 54. Urara is lying on the bed and she's just frustrated with herself, right? She's saying, I'm getting jealous of pretty people. I'm tired. And like, Sakura-kun, it's amazing that you can just love what you love. I want to be like you.
Yeah.
And that to me kind of like, that was like, maybe that was the moment of explaining what makes a boys love manga so resonant or so meaningful to that this reader, right? It's like, you can imagine, like people have said, like with boys love manga, why it's different than just, you know, a traditional male-female romance is that you can imagine yourself as a female reader to be either boy.
Mm-hmm.
You can either be the aggressor or the passive one. You can be the top or the bottom. You can put yourself in either role. And you don't have to compare yourself to the, you know, like if it was a female character, go like, oh, well, she's pretty. Oh, well, she's like this. I'm not like that. And yeah. with Boys Love, you can kind of project yourself on either character, whatever your interests or fantasies are. But it's just interesting, yeah? Because it's not, it doesn't seem to be about this. In Urata's case, it's not about being titillated by the sex, but it's about the realness of the relationship or the drama of the relationship.
Yeah. And the connection.
I would like to posit that it is also about the sex. And
it probably is, yes. But it's not in this book.
Because we find out she's got a box of slightly more mature manga in the very first volume. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about this particular title and her relationship, like how she relates to Ichinoi about it. But even Ichinoi, it starts reading all the really dirty, smutty doujinshi stuff as well and loves it. But you just don't focus there because it's not what this is necessarily about. It's funny. I was actually going through the show notes, the photos for the show notes, and I found a photo I took of this on the shelf when it was being talked about as like a hot new title. And it was right next to another book that was actually another book that was an essay manga, slightly more nonfiction than this one is, I guess, that was also about two women discussing BL and what they like about BL. And that series hasn't been licensed, whereas this one was. And it's very much the difference between like, that was an essay manga. An essay manga rarely gets licensed in North America. And this really is about talking about BL, but talking about friendship and how this is like a way that people connect and talk about their own feelings as opposed to talking about the work itself. And I think that's kind of huge. I'll try and figure out what that other title was and put it in the show notes for this episode. Yeah, it's really neat.
Yeah. As host, I am looking that we're coming up near the hour mark, and the duties of a host is to have things move swiftly. What are your final thoughts? And I'm going to start with, let's see, Chris.
You're such a dick. My final thoughts.
You got 2 seconds. One.
Good.
Two.
That's it. I got it. It's good.
It's good.
It's good.
I actually want a Paradise Kiss style 5-in-1 omnibus of this one day. I've got all the physical vault ones except for number 5, which I'll pick up. But I think I want a nice all-in-one edition of this. I hope Seven Seas is able. I hope the paper shortage stops and people are able to print manga again. But I hope Seven Seas is able to do that one day. I think that this is a book that deserves to be read from beginning to end.
Has this been a popular series in North America?
I don't know.
With a certain kind of reader. Short answer: if it's not a shonen title, like or a very rare exception, it's not selling the crazy numbers. But this is one of them. But this is, people talk about this book, which I think is really key. I don't know if we'll ever know if it was a financial sales success or anything like that. But I don't think it was, especially for the first couple volumes, I don't think it was a failure.
Yeah. All right. Deb, you're up next. Final thoughts.
Well, I think the volume 3, 4, and 5 definitely deliver on the promise of 1 and 2. It's a really nice collection of story. It ends on a really great note. Gives you a lot to think about. It rewards repeat rereadings because you see hints of what happens later in the previous chapters. It's just a really lovely, lovely warm heart, warm spirited read that has a little bittersweetness. And yeah, it's just really nice. It's a great book about friendship. I don't think the title does it any favors, honestly.
I actually have a question about that. Like, my one qualm with the book, and I guess this also doubles as part of my final thought, is that it's really good, but the Japanese title was Veranda of Metamorphosis, and the book ends on a veranda, and she's literally like, it's like the prow of a boat, and then there's the last page, and she runs off. And I feel like there's like just one missed metaphor in there, something that didn't quite make it into translation for whatever reason. And it's probably just, you know, there's too much of a play on words, too much of a, you know, too much wordplay to make it through into localized. But other than that, like,
we can ask
glorious.
Jocelyn about it.
Oh yeah, true.
I would like to, I think putting BL in the title as a sales was probably not a bad sales thing, because BL actually sells pretty well, particularly in digital. But I think, there's another final thought. I don't know. I think you can read this and not even like BL. It's such a good story about two people. You could even actively dislike BL for whatever reason and still find a lot to really love in this series. And I wonder, because it's BL is a tool that they use to explore the series, if that was the best choice, particularly because BL wasn't in the Japanese title. It was, you know, Engawa. It was like veranda, like David's saying. And that end of the book metaphor did not land where she's sitting on the Engawa, the veranda again, and goes, oh, it's like being on the prow of a ship, because she's looking into her future and she's like looking into the distance and whatever. You know, you're absolutely right. And I don't know.
So that's sometimes basically my only complaint is that there's one little spot that I miss and would like someone to talk about to me after they listen to this episode. Other than that, great job. Well done.
Nice. My final thoughts are...
Wait. Did we interrupt Deb? Deb, did you have a final...
No,
did
no.
You...
That okay, was it.
Sorry. So David, cut this part. Chip, start over. 3, 2, 1.
Chris, stop pretending to be the host here.
I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
I'm the host now.
You are the host. Go on.
And my final thoughts are, this was a very good book. So anyways, let's pause for a commercial, and we'll be right back with more Mangasplaining.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I hope you enjoyed those commercials, which are all very much endorsed by us. Now that we're back, it's time for Q&A, but I'm the one with the Q this week. Before we started recording, the four of us were talking, and Deb mentioned something about American Comics Code, and it got me thinking, is there such a thing as a Japanese Comics Code? And if not... what are the rules or laws that have evolved to handle manga? Go.
That is a really good question. Can I try that one, Chris?
Thank you.
I mean, my contention is that there is, but it's not like the comic. It's not as codified as a comics code where it had to be, everything has to be reviewed. However, there is definite rules, right? Like the no penises. And no pubic hair.
Unless they're drawn like elephants, in which case it's okay. Like Han Shinchan and Dragon Ball.
You just asked a big question, yo. Basically, non-sexual nudity in Japan isn't a big deal. There's public bathing, which we've all gone and done. Sorry, not all of us listening, but all of us participating in the podcast. Like being naked around other people, kind of just not a big deal. So especially... young people, like being nude before you enter puberty, it's not a thing. Like until you're 5, if you're a boy, you can go in the girl's side of the bathhouse with your mom because she's the one who took you. And same thing if you're a girl, vice versa. Like it's just so like Crayon Shin-Chan or Goku when he's like a little kid, you know, his wiener hanging out, not a big deal in Japan. Very big deal here. And I'm not going to go over that again. I'll just link it. But basically, yeah, people freak out here about that kind of thing. But there are rules governing it, like you can't really show penises at all or like vagina stuff. And that's where like
vagina stuff.
Well, like, so there's a, let's use actual real names. So there's a wonderful lady named Rokuro Nashiko who did a book, which means like nasty woman basically, but she did a book that was basically about how she took a 3D model of her vulva and turned it into a boat. She 3D printed it and then sailed around in her boat, and her model and her boat were cited for obscenity. Her manga is called Was Obscenity. It's unfortunately out of print right now, which is like a huge bummer, but she came to TCAF, since we're talking about TCAF this episode anyway. She's great. Just the existence of mature people's body parts is obscene within Japan. And her contention is that it shouldn't be. Around the same time as she was dealing with her shit, there was a gay artist who would do sort of erotic gay nude photography, huge in Japan, that would have wieners in it. Did not go over well with the Japanese police. It was shut down. He was fined, blah, blah, blah. So like there is obscenity. There are things that are considered obscene. Those things have changed. Like you have to mosaic it out. Like you have to black it out or do like a little mosaic filter or whatever. It used to be you couldn't show pubic hair at all. And now that you can, just as long as it's in a non-sexual context. And also there's no wieners or hard wieners or exposed you know, parts, I guess. So it's like a whole, there's a whole thing, and it applies equally to all forms of media, including,
yeah,
there aren't special manga rules, but individual publishers will have different standards that they adhere to, particularly within different age groups of magazines. What you can get away with at a Shueisha Jump magazine isn't what you can get away with in Jump Plus, isn't what you can get away with in a book that skips going into a magazine at all and comes out as an original graphic novel. And that's, yeah, that's the general rule, but that's a real fast and loose rule that is,
yeah,
not evenly applied.
So it's a genital based thing, but there aren't any really rules governing like depictions of crime or violence.
That is,
I don't think so.
Generally, yeah, correct, mm-hmm, but there are, if something is too close to an existing crime, for example, like if something uses real life, whatever, there's no rule against it, but you can also be sued for profiting off of like the proceeds of a crime. So if something real happens and you don't clear it with all the people, like the family members of the survivors, sorry to get real dark here for a sec, but, or whatever, they can sue you for like emotional trauma and whatever, and win, like 100% chance that they're going to win because you didn't, yeah, clear it with them first. It's, yeah, but it also, that's where you get into like, you know, all kinds of exciting hentai that is weird and wacky and wild and not always okay as well. It's because you can draw these things, but as long as you black out the only part that you have to black out to keep the censors happy, there's nothing illegal about it, yeah, within its context in Japan. And that is also changing. So the person who's in charge of Kadokawa in Japan, Kadokawa is the parent company of Yen Press in North America, but they also licensed other publishers, put out a statement, I think last month, that said, look, we're just going to have to start self-censoring because people around the world, you know, Kadokawa just opened a theme park, by the way, north of Tokyo. So they've got around the world on the mind lately. But he put out a statement that was like, yeah, we're going to have to start self-censoring because some stuff is too weird and we can't just keep putting out hentai and whatever. And it hurts people's opinions of our culture industries, which is manga and anime and whatever. Comments didn't go over well.
Yeah,
but it's the same thing that happened to the Tokyo mayor maybe 10 years ago, and then the Osaka mayor, who's just talking about obscenity. Like, yeah, it's a real pickle.
Yeah, where you can't show the pickle.
You can't. Well, sorry, you could put a pickle over it, though.
Gotcha.
And here's the other thing. I've got books in my collection that show all of the bits. If you're a smaller publisher, you can just do what you want to do, roll the dice and hope you don't get noticed. You know what, yeah, I mean?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing here. It's like with the undergrounds, we're depicting drug use, which could be considered illegal in some jurisdictions at the time in the 1970s. So they would do it, you know, with like fake names, or they'd do it in mail order directly to people. And, you know, the most famous comics case in North America is someone who drew a thing, someone ordered it directly from them. And because they deemed it as obscene and it crossed state lines, that person went to prison, like prison. That's, yeah, the Mike Deanna case. And it's just, yeah, like, yeah, like North America's laws are, I think, worse in every way than Japan's,
sure,
personally. But also, like, that kind of artistic freedom, you don't get it back once you give it up.
Yeah.
So I caution and urge our Japanese friends to fight back against self-censorship whenever possible. Deb, did you have anything you want? Sorry, and I jumped in, but I think Deb has just as much insight into this kind of stuff.
No, I was just going to say that my hot take on this has always been that if Japan's manga scene is basically what would happen to America if we didn't have the comics code and Seduction of the Innocent.
Mm.
Because Japan just continued on this trajectory of making adult, violent, anything goes manga.
Mm-hmm.
And then America just had like, went off this cliff where, like, after EC, boom, that's it. There was like this, there's this long pause, and then that maybe comes up again with underground comics, but it takes a long time for American mainstream comics to go back to this adult place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when it did come back to this adult place, it went back with a vengeance. So, yeah, like women in refrigerators kind of thing. And,
yeah, a friend of mine jokes that every superhero writer's first Image comic is always the one with all the boobs and cuss words. Looks like they can finally unleash.
Yeah.
So it's its own thing, right? So I still think that what some people really like about manga still has that sense of, oh my God, almost anything goes.
Yeah.
That you can't get away with in American comics. And it's delightful and surprising and you know, it's just kind of like, ooh, titillating, you know, crazy. Like, oh, so creative, so free, so nuts. Like, yeah, bears, boobs, whatever, you know?
Yeah, like bears, boobs, and whatever. You're on mongasplaining.com.
So, I don't know.
So, a follow-up question then. What about that most flagrant and fantastical of crimes, homosexuality? Mm. How is Japan, like, I'm thinking about, because we're talking about boys love manga, like, when did it start, and was there any kind of pushback against depictions of gay romance in manga? Like, what? Yes. What? I don't even know what the Japanese laws are in regards to homosexuality. What the history of it is?
It was never criminalized.
Yeah,
and homosexuality was practiced pretty late, but. How can I say this without offending a huge chunk of our audience? It was the introduction of Western ideals into Japan after the opening of the country in the late 1800s and early 1900s that maybe showed that the gay shit wasn't cool. And it turns out the gay shit is cool and super cool, and you know they should have stuck along, but it became unfashionable, let's say, for that to happen. And it's always existed in the shadows, but because of that, because the public sentiment turned against it, there was a lot of pressure to erase a lot of gay works and a lot of gay history within, which, you know, anyone who's ever studied gay history anywhere in the world knows that there's always a lot of pressure to erase the gays out of history. Yeah. But yeah, straight up, it's a weird situation because, yeah, queerness is like kind of an integral part to a lot of things that we think of as Japanese, especially samurai culture, for example. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't get talked about within Japan, especially in a contemporary context. And it only really comes out in porn, because in porn, it's already pornographic. It's already like hentai, like ecchi, like whatever. It's already bad, like air quotes, bad.
It's already gone past that point.
So you can say whatever you want to, but like not just samurai, but also like monks. I'll never forget. I was with Jocelyn in a bookstore. We were out in Chiba actually. And I picked up this manga, this like BL manga that was about two like shaven headed bald Buddhist monks in the 1800s, and the quote on the cover saying you should buy this, because there was like an obi strip on it, was from the dude who does Golden Kamuy, and Jocelyn reads it and laughs, and I'm like, what? And she's like, I'll just basically, this quote says, oh my god, this manga is so hot, I read it and I was really embarrassed by how turned on I got, you know, straight dude Golden Kamuy, as like him recommending this like super hot BL manga about monks. And it was just like, yeah, I think things are changing for sure. But yeah, there's
pull quotes in Japan are really different, aren't they?
Pull quotes, yeah, wow. I'm sorry, if you're a BL publisher, you can do whatever the fuck you want.
That's like a chip level pull quote.
I love it.
It's tough to gauge as like a straight comics fan in the US. Like the, what I know of gay culture here and gay culture there, if there's a better phrase for that, please forgive me. Like, I can't figure some things out sometimes.
Yeah.
Like in One Piece, for instance, there's a character, Bon Clay, Mr. Number Two, who is a crossdresser, but it's done in a way where you're like, I don't know if this is transphobic, but it probably isn't. But then he's a great character, so hopefully it isn't. But I should probably, you know, like, talk to some people about it, you know? Mm. But I guess much less controversial in Japan, because he's part of a tradition that they understand better, like, you know, it being part of their culture. So as like an American fan, I try to be very careful with like the conclusions that I come to.
Cross-dressing in Japan roughly equates to cross-dressing in Britain up until about 10 years ago, where it's like, yeah, every comedian, you know, if they're on an ensemble comedy show, we'll do a bit where they dress up like women. Kids in the Hall, that was their biggest thing, one of the biggest things they took from British comedy. Mm. Obviously, in the last 10 years, the TERFs have horribly taken hold of the British comedy world. It's really weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, straight up, it's the gayest. But it's cultural. It's cultural mores. It's just different cultural mores. Like, and being cross-dresser is different than being trans and whatnot. There's, you know, you can right now, I'll put it in the show notes. Speaking of Jocelyn, she helped work on a documentary called Queer Japan, which actually gets into sort of all of these ideas and many, many more, and includes an interview with Tagame-sensei, Gengoro Tagame, the mangaka, that talks about how queerness interacts with specifically manga as well. But
that's like exactly what I want to read.
Yeah.
Or watch, I guess.
It's a documentary. It's really good.
It's an hour and a half long documentary. It's totally worth your time. I like it. It's beautifully shot, too. So just to quickly actually answer your question, because I'm terrible at that, Chip. I'm so sorry. The first openly boys love story is generally considered Heart of Thomas in 1974 by Moto Hagio. And in three episodes, we're going to read another book by Moto Hagio, because Heart of Thomas is or is not in print. It's Schrodinger's in print right now.
It's being reprinted, but yeah, not, sure. it's not readily available right now.
Like maybe, like no one can get time at the printers. But yeah, I think they intend to reprint. But anyway, we're going to read some Moto Hagio. But that was actually really deeply influenced by British film. So the British cinema had stuff that was instituted later, but it didn't have the Hays Code. The Hays Code in the U.S., which sort of crippled film, so that you couldn't show queers at all. Or if they did, they had to be like just the worst possible light, like murderers and rapists and whatever. If anyone is gay, lesbian, by anything, they're awful. So that's the Hays Code, and that changed film. But yeah, boarding school dramas in the 1960s and 70s, where two boys at a British boarding school become friends and then maybe more, there's like a whole genre of that shit. And this is the manga, the shoujo manga version of that. And it was a transformative work that inspired a lot of works that came after. But more to your point and to what David was getting at, this genre became so popular that it became the overriding genre of doujinshi, to the point that SF doujinshi maker, like the dudes who were making doujinshi at the time in the 1970s, pushed back against it to an insane degree. Like, if you want to get real deep on fan cultures in Japan, you can, because they've meticulously cataloged their own fan culture. But like the early comiquettes, there were real fights about how much to not include women, because women were always kind of okay as long as they didn't talk about the gay shit. So there's like SF, like science fiction doujinshi versus BL doujinshi, and these passionate fights. Anyway, it got sorted out. Wasn't dealt with.
Comiket founded by co-founded by a group of like female doujinshi artists?
There are a lot of cooks that have seasoned that particular broth in the beginning, and it grew out of a bunch of fan associations. But yeah, there's the Memorial Museum. Deb, we went to that. There's a Memorial Museum in one of the little neighborhoods in Tokyo, and I just remember that it's at the top of a hill in like the worst, most annoying way. But it's like one of the dudes who founded Comiket.
Oh, the Yonezawa Museum.
The Yonezawa Museum.
It's at Meiji. I think it's at one of
Meiji
the universities. And I don't think so. I think it is, but it's the guy who founded Comiket.
Yeah,
he left his whole library, his collection, to the university.
Wow.
This is what I referred to before. Like he had his collection was like Raiders of the Lost Ark warehouse level.
A warehouse of comics and doujinshi and fan publications going back. So I've gotten to see the program, I think it was from the second or third ever Comiket in the 1970s. That was kind of cool.
Sounds face meltingly cool.
Oh my goodness. It's really well started.
I get your reference.
That was very good. You're all much better than me. Anyway, I've said enough, but basically we're going to start getting into the origins of BL manga a little bit with the Moto Hagio Drunken Dream. And I think I would love to read a BL manga on the podcast at some point. I think that would be really cool. But I don't, all my BL knowledge is 10 years at a date, because it's been a long time since I sold books for a living. So yeah, maybe we can open it up.
We've been threatening Chip with Dick Fight Island for a while
now. That one's a must.
Is that boys love?
Yeah. That's how men relate to each other, is on the battlefield.
This is true.
But upcoming on Manga Explaining, you mentioned Drunken Dream, and the episode after that is Raw Hero. So we're kind of doing Boys Love and Obscenity back to back.
So
it's going to be a very fun couple of weeks of Manga Explaining, I think.
I'm going to have to recommend Doraemon so we can bring it back down.
We're going to have to find some way to fix the curve.
yeah.
But Chip, that was a great question. It made Chris say wiener like 12 times.
that's what I always hope for when I host an episode of Manga Explaining. We're doing shout outs. So, hey, who's got shout outs this week? Let's start with Chris.
My shout out this week is the awesome new music video by Dua Lipa which is the third video for her song Levitating, and it is animated like it is a late 80s, early 90s Sailor Moon episode, and it's so awesome. And apparently it's done by like this fan group that's called Nostaluk, and I'll put it all in the show notes. But yeah, like, it's a bop of a song and has like a real good like 80s, 90s disco kind of like bop vibe, and it is so good. But the animation in this is chef's kiss perfect. I love this music
love
video.
It.
And the right. song too. Check it out.
Put it in the show notes.
It's in the show notes.
Deb, how about you? Shoutouts?
Mine's is not that good. Not as good as that. But I did really enjoy a new shoujo manga called In the Clear Moonlight Dusk by Mika Yamamori. It's from Kodansha. It's about a girl who looks very masculine, and she's very chivalrous, and everyone calls her the prince. And then she falls in love, or thinks she's falling in love, or this guy comes onto her, and he's also considered a prince and unattainable. So it's basically these two characters having kind of this interesting romantic tension. I really enjoy it.
Sounds good. Chris, put in the show notes.
Done.
David, what's your shout out?
My shout's a challenge to our listeners. I thought of this while reading BL Metamorphosis, but if you had to do a BL Metamorphosis that was just as kind, but with another genre, what would you do? Oh. Let us know on Twitter in the comments. Be as serious or as joking as you want. But it's such like a fun manga that I'm wondering if you could do it with like, I don't know, action like, comedies?
Like Marvel Superhero Metamorphosis? Is that what you're...
Yeah.
No, you know what you got to do, David? You got to do the action movie Metamorphosis with you and your grandma talking about John Wick.
Oh, we totally could. Oh, yeah, it would be very
so
easy.
So good.
We'd probably have to call it Patriot Games Metamorphosis, though. That's like the origin of all of it.
Wow.
That's cool.
Nice. I love it. Chris, put it in the show notes.
Done.
My shout out. Look, I just finished The Sopranos last night. That's it. A series from 20 years ago. It's not much of a shout out.
I hear it's good.
Yeah, it was. It's always weird watching a show from 20 years ago, especially one that was like edgy. Because it's like every 10 minutes I'm like, is this okay today? But there's a lot of violence and probably too many boobs.
Wow.
And yet I still enjoyed it.
Can there really be too many boobs?
Yes, actually.
I've seen some anime. I think so.
It's like the main character owns a strip club. So like every episode is just like a gratuitous scene in the strip club with just like women just slowly dancing. I'm just like, I don't actually like this.
Is that where the HBO thing Sexposition came from? Where they're always like delivering important plot points?
That was Game of Thrones.
Okay.
But you could see how Sopranos could also fall into that category. Yeah.
It's like, well, why else are you on cable TV?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I will say James Gandolfini might be the best actor of all time.
He's like, really good.
There are a lot of scenes that I'm just like, wow, like, I can't believe the range he's got.
And just hot. Oh, so hot.
Okay, well, that's the other thing. Like, you kind of like halfway through, you're just like, oh, wait, no, I get it. I get why like ladies are into him. At first, you're like, yeah. No way. But he's smoldering.
My sub shout out is to watch The Drop with Tom Hardy and Gandolfini.
Oh yeah, no, that's great with the dog.
Yeah, really good. Great book too.
Oh really? Okay. Yeah, I love it. Sub shout out, fantastic. All right. Well, I think that's it. So I'm gonna wrap it up as long as Chris doesn't want to interrupt and tell me we got to do something else.
Cutting all this out.
You're cutting all this out?
This has been Mangasplaining, episode number 34. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing City, Volume 1 by Kiichi Arai. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or
Check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Special thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode. See ya!
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.